From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. With Cheers and Becker behind him, Ted Danson has stepped out of the sitcom world into more unconventional TV. He plays himself on Larry David's HBO series, Curb Your Enthusiasm. He's given riveting performances as a corrupt billionaire CEO on the FX series, Damages. And he co-stars in the new HBO series, Bored to Death, which premieres this weekend. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Danson about TV and life. Also, we sent our producer Anne-Marie Baldonado to the Toronto Film Festival. She'll tell us about her favorite film at the festival and some of the films getting Oscar buzz. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In case you haven't noticed, Ted Danson has been doing some really interesting work on TV lately, playing characters very different from the shallow and vain bartender Sam Malone on the sitcom Cheers. On the FX series Damages, he's played a corrupt billionaire CEO. On Larry David's HBO series Curb Your Enthusiasm, Ted Danson and his wife Mary Steenburgen play versions of themselves, friends of Larry David. Now Danson co-stars in the new series Bored to Death, which premieres Sunday on HBO. It was created by writer Jonathan Ames. The series stars Jason Schwartzman as a writer named Jonathan Ames, who's stuck. He's not getting anywhere with his writing, and his girlfriend has just walked out on him, accusing him of drinking too much and smoking too much marijuana. So he tries to emulate the life of the hard-boiled detectives in his favorite novels. He puts an ad on Craigslist offering his services as a private detective, and he starts getting responses. Ted Danson plays George Christopher, a powerful editor at a magazine Ames writes for. In this scene from the first episode, they're at a gallery opening when Danson asks Schwartzman if he has any pot. He does, so they go into the men's room. Danson is surprised to see that Schwartzman is carrying his marijuana in a prescription pill bottle.
This is my Viagra bottle. What are you doing with marijuana in my Viagra bottle?
You gave me that bottle months ago. There were two pills left in it. You told me I should try them. Now I'm putting my pot in
it. Are you insane? What if you got arrested for marijuana possession? Page Six would have a field day. I can't have... Hello? Hello? I can't have the world knowing that I use Viagra.
Do you really need to take so much?
Yes, as a matter of fact, I do. My heart medicine and heavy drinking have taken a toll. I'm not what I once was, but I accept that. It's called humility.
Why are you back on pot?
Because I'm bored. God, I'm bored. Death by a thousand dull conversations. I don't know what's going on, but almost everybody has bad wine breath tonight. It's like Chernobyl out there.
Do you think we drink too much?
No, we don't drink too much. Men face reality, women don't. That's why men need to drink.
That's a line from my novel.
Yeah, well, you stole it from me.
No, I didn't.
Yeah, actually, you did.
Actually, no, I didn't.
Fine, Jonathan.
Anyway, Suzanne moved out today because she says I drink too much.
Well, I'm not surprised.
Why do you say that?
Because you're like me, Jonathan. We enthrall and then we disappoint.
Ted Danson, welcome to Fresh Air.
That's a great line. I love that.
Yeah, it's a great line.
We enthrall and then we disappoint.
Yeah. Jonathan Ames created this series, Bored to Death. What did he tell you about who he based your character on?
He didn't... I don't know that he said that he based it on anyone specific. He, you know, I read a book about George Plimpton, but clearly this is not George Plimpton. It was a very small character in the beginning, and then when I came on board, and they decided to make it bigger. So I'm not. You'd have to ask him if he had anybody specific, but I don't think he did. For me, I kind of drew on my father's day, if not directly my father, that old world gentleman, very bright, well spoken, kind of. Old world style person who always wears a tie kind of, person.
It's funny that you say you wanted to base the character on your father's kind of old school ways, old world ways. Mm-hmm. But this is a character who smokes marijuana and, drinks too much. And I mean, that's, your father wouldn't have been doing that, I don't think.
No. No. But no, he wasn't. But there's the one side of him that is, he's very bright, very intelligent. He's the editor and publisher of a well-respected magazine. He rubs shoulders with very intelligent, bright, literary people in New York. So he can play that game. And then there's part of him that hasn't quite grown up and has had too many marriages, too many parties, and what he I think what he really wants in life is to not be left out by youth. Let me do whatever Jason Schwartzman's character is doing. Please don't leave me out. Are you smoking marijuana? Then I want some. Are you having a colonic? Oh, I want a colonic. You know, it's whatever Jason is doing. Please don't leave me out. I want to still be excited by life. So take me with you.
You're getting to play much more varied characters than you did when you were younger and famous originally. Because mm-hmm. people got so used to you as Sam Malone, the bartender on Cheers, who was the opposite of intellectual. And the power that he had was like the power in the bar. But now you're playing people who have like, you know, real power, who are kind of successful and also often like self-delusional and sometimes with a little bit of an evil streak. And it's been really fun for me as a viewer to discover that side of you as an actor.
Fun for me, too. I have to admit, I think part of me thought I had stayed at the half-hour comedy dance a bit too long. And I think part of me was going, wow, I'm not as funny as these other people who are coming up. And I was kind of boring myself in a way. And then Damages came along and really kind of turned things around for me.
Well, you mentioned Damages, so there's a perfect opportunity to play a scene from it. And Damages is an FX series starring Glenn Close as a lawyer. And in this, you play Arthur Frobisher, a billionaire CEO who cashed in his stocks, and then the company went under, leaving the employees without jobs or pensions. So they hired a lawyer, the Glenn Close character, to file a class action suit against you. You really want to save your reputation. So one of the things you've done is get a writer to write a book about you. But the writer has his own idea. And, you know, he wants to do some investigation, find out who you really are, what you've really done in your life, some of the bad things you've done in your life. You see this book as an opportunity to just, like, burnish your reputation and talk about, you know, like, your ladder to success and overcoming the odds. So you show up very inappropriately at midnight, unannounced, at the writer's house.
And slightly drunk.
And slightly drunk with a whole box of like your trophies and your ribbons and memorabilia that's designed to show him what each of these things represent in your life and what you had to go through to achieve the success that each of these objects represent. So here's the scene.
No, see, look, this stuff, all this is my integrity. So I'm here, look. Third prize, middle school spelling bee.
Great.
No, I'm dyslexic. Remember I told you that? So that's determination. Here, look. Yeah, all right, varsity. This is interesting. Varsity, that's the first time I realized that I was a natural leader.
Yeah, you know, all this stuff that you're giving me is great. Yeah. But this book...
All right, look. All right, here, come here. This shirt, right? Shirt you're wearing, you own other shirts, right? So if I come along and say, you know, define you as the guy who wears this shirt, I'd be wrong, right? Because you're not just one thing. See, that's what I'm trying to say. You're not just one thing. Hey, I told you, right, that I started off dirt poor.
You told me yesterday about that.
Well, why don't you write, see? All right, hey, listen. 17, I came this close to joining the army. Realize what that meant?
Look, Mr. Frobisher, I haven't seen Indira for 2 weeks. She has been traveling, understand, and this is our night together. So we'll just cut it short.
Wait, all right, let's back up here. Tell me about your book.
My novel?
Sorry, your novel.
It's hard to describe.
Just tell me what it's about.
On the face of it, it's a love story. It's about nostalgia and how that affects our core relationships.
Jesus, George. I mean, that sounds like crap. Are you kidding me? Look what you're doing here. I mean, you're sleeping on a futon. Come on. I mean, you know, of course you're writing about my life. You don't have one, you know? And you're immigrant because what?
Excuse
you
know, me?
You appreciate their
Excuse
culture.
Excuse me?
Is that what you're saying to yourself? The truth is, you're just trying to feel superior. Try running a A $40 billion industry. See how that makes you feel?
Get out!
Yeah, try managing 11,000 employees.
Just leave!
You want to know why they're suing me, you invisible piece of because I'm worth it.
I hope that you lose everything.
Yeah, you be careful.
Because you are an arrogant
Hey, guess what? You're fired.
And that punch was the sound of the Ted Danson character hitting the ghostwriter really hard, maybe breaking his nose. That's such a great scene.
With my little toy car.
That's right. I love the way you play that scene. There's a lot of words that you only like half say. It's almost like it's partly because you're drunk, but it's partly because like time is, you're so important and you have so little time, you don't even have to say the whole word,
yeah.
You know, because
yeah.
I read, by the way, I feel like I read the book that you wanted written, the total like self-delusional, self-burnishing kind of memoir. I've seen that book. You've said that you worked with an acting coach before doing Damages, and I guess I'm wondering why you've acted for decades. Why did you feel the need to do that?
I did work with an acting coach right beforehand. His name's Harold Guskin, and he's worked with a lot of people. Glenn Close actually has worked with him. James Gandolfini and the producers, Glenn and the writers, Glenn and Todd Kessler knew him for years and actually pulled me aside about 2 days before we started shooting the pilot and said, we'd love you to go see our acting coach. And it was like, uh-oh. You know, they hate my work. They want me to do something that they don't think I'm capable of. But it was fantastic because what he told me was, we just talked, you know, read the scene once and kind of talked about it. And what he said to me was actually kind of exciting for me just as an actor because I had been doing comedy half hour for so long, which has this rhythm to it. It's almost like doing a musical. There is in this, it's not a real metronome going off in the background, but it feels like it. There is a rhythm you need to adhere to, even if you disguise it. You know, there is a clean musical comedy energy to doing half hour. And it was very nice to come and do this drama. And what he said to me was, you know, don't, you have four lines you're about to do. You have a paragraph in the script. Well, maybe you're going to say one line. Maybe you'll say two. Maybe you won't feel like saying the other lines, and maybe you won't. You're Arthur Frobisher. You'll do what you want when you want. And if you don't feel like, you know, you don't be the nice actor. Don't give them what they want. Do whatever you want. And he instilled this kind of creative arrogance in me that was the same arrogance of the character, the billionaire who doesn't really have to answer to anyone and can do whatever he wants because people love him because he's a billionaire. And he kind of instilled in me the idea of acting from that point of view of, you know what, if you don't like this line, don't say it. Now, the lines were brilliant, so I said them, but there was that kind of arrogance of I can do no wrong. And it was really a great note to give me.
My guest is Ted Danson. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Ted Danson, and he's now co-starring in a new series that premieres this weekend on HBO called Bored to Death. On HBO in the Larry David series, Curb Your Enthusiasm, you've played yourself, Ted Danson. And your wife, Mary Steenburgen, plays your wife and plays herself. So when you started on Curb Your Enthusiasm, how did you figure out who the Curb version of Ted Danson was going to be?
You know, it's probably the same way that I figure out all parts. I'm very bad at doing homework. I can't look at a suit on a rack and go, oh, I'd like that suit. I have to try it on. So I try on words. I read the board. If it's a well thought out, very creative writer, you know, that you respect, then you try on the words and you go, you know, when I say these words, it makes me feel this way, or I feel like doing this. I think it's the same thing, even though you're playing yourself. You go, all right, what is my function here? My function is to be a foil for Larry David. My function is to set up roadblocks or do something that heighten what he's really funny at, you know, funny at. So it becomes, you shape yourself, even though your name's Ted Danson and you're married to Mary Steenburgen, but the truth is you are trying to do what's best in each scene to highlight Larry, which is why I hate Larry. I don't really like him. I'm tired of highlighting Larry. I'm glad you laugh because he's one of our best friends and we, you know, see him all the time socially, and he's lived in our guest house for 2 summers in a row. Mary calls him Larry the Lodger. He just won't leave.
So is this why you're in the series? Because you're already friends?
Yeah, I probably.
So are there scenes in episodes of Curb that actually came out of your life or came out of your real relationship with Larry David?
Not necessarily, although when you go out to dinner with him, it's way scarier than acting with him because he's always pulling out his notebook, or you don't know whether or not he's doing a scene in a restaurant and being a little louder than he should be because he's practicing something for next week, or whether this is truly Larry. It's a very scary kind of proposition, hanging out with Larry David.
Well, I can imagine it would be a little embarrassing when he's talking too loud or doing something inappropriate, and you don't know whether he's testing a performance or just being weird.
We've sat in a restaurant, a very sweet, quiet inn, you know, New England inn, with a lot of people with kind of blue-gray hair. And he came in late, and his back was to the entire restaurant, but we were looking at the entire restaurant over his shoulder. And he was whispering this story in a kind of stage whisper that had the F word in it a lot. And he basically cleared the restaurant. And then as he's walking out, he went, nice restaurant. A little too quiet for a Jew, but it's a nice restaurant. And walked out, and it was like, and you kind of have to walk in his wake going, sorry, you know, it's Larry, sorry.
That sounds so much like it should be on Curb, and maybe it will
be. Yeah, and will be, right.
I want to play a scene from Curb Your Enthusiasm. This is an episode in which you and your wife, Mary Steenburgen, have invited Larry David and his wife to a party. And he doesn't like parties. He doesn't want to go. So he comes.
This is real.
This is real.
Totally
great,
real.
Great.
This summer, he would not go to people's homes for dinner. I'll go to a restaurant because then I can leave when I want. But at a home, I'm stuck. I don't want to come. And he made this a rule of thumb. Anyway, please go on.
Okay. So in this scene, he doesn't want to go to your party. So he comes up with this scheme that he'll pretend that he thought your party was really the next day. So the day after the party, he shows up at your door and, you know, saying, oh, okay, we're here for the party. And he expects that you'll say, oh, it was last night, and then he could just go home. But that's not what happens. So here's the scene.
Hey!
What you guys doing?
What's going on?
What do you mean?
Where is everybody?
We thought there was a party.
Oh, my God. You thought the party was tonight?
Yeah.
Last night. The party was last night.
Are you kidding me?
No, man.
That's unbelievable. What? We got the wrong night?
Yeah, you did.
Jesus Christ. Holy cow.
I was actually glad to hear this. I was a little pissed off that you didn't call.
Well, now you know why we didn't call.
Hey, Mary.
Of course we didn't call, because we're coming tonight.
Come on in.
No.
We're not going to come in.
Yeah, come in.
No.
We got the wrong night. It's our fault.
It doesn't matter.
Hey, Mary. We're
the party is tonight.
So stupid.
You're kidding.
Can you believe how stupid we are?
All right, it's good to see you guys. We'll call you later.
No way you're leaving. This is fantastic. We have so much leftover food. You're going to come in and help us eat it.
You know what? I'll call you tomorrow.
Yes.
We'll get together. We'll do the whole
thing. Why?
I'll take you out to dinner. I'm paying.
Hey, Larry. You don't have any plans. You're supposed to be here, and you're here. Come on in. Come on, Cheryl. Be fun. Come on in. This will be fun. Hey, we got leftovers. Make an omelet or something. Come on.
Sure. Guys, oh yeah. We can't.
That'd be great. Come on.
This is like pulling teeth. Come on in, you guys.
That's a scene from Curb Your Enthusiasm, with my guest Ted Danson. So let's look at the scene that we just heard.
Okay.
Did you get a script for that scene? Did Larry David tell you what it was about and then ask you to just improv your lines? How did it work?
Yeah, that's something everybody should know about Larry David. He's the laziest writer on the planet. You know, if he ever wins a writing award, I'll pick it. I'm semi-joking. What he does is he works for months on setting up the season, the arc of the season. Then each show is broken down into scenes. And this is pretty typical of a writing room for comedies. You break everything down beat by beat so that the last thing you do is you send a writer off to write the actual dialogue. He takes it right up to the dialogue part. So it's very intricate. It's been worked out. You know what he needs, but the words that come out of your mouth have not been written.
Our interview with Ted Danson will continue in the second half of the show. His new series, Bored to Death, premieres Sunday on HBO. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from LendingTree, providing customers with the ability to manage their money, credit, and loans all in one place at LendingTree.com. From Reprise Records, presenting Mark Knopfler. His latest album, Get Lucky, is available now. More information at MarkKnopfler.com. And from Anchor Bay Entertainment, presenting the Starz original series, Crash, the complete first season, on DVD and Blu-ray, available from Netflix. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Ted Danson tells us why he initially had a hard time playing the arrogant and shallow bartender Sam Malone on Cheers. Also, our producer Anne-Marie Baldonado just returned from the Toronto Film Festival. She'll tell us about her favorite film and some of the films getting Oscar buzz. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Ted Danson. He co-stars in the HBO series Bored to Death, which premieres Sunday. He plays himself on Larry David's HBO series Curb Your Enthusiasm, and on the FX series Damages, he's played a corrupt billionaire CEO. Now, you got your start on the TV series Cheers, which is one of the more famous TV series in TV history. How did you get the audition for that?
You know, I think several things I heard later, you know, came out later. Jimmy Burrows, who, along with Glenn and Les Charles, created Cheers. He was the director. They were the two writers. And they had been teamed up for a few years. And I had auditioned for Jimmy Burrows, maybe a year or two beforehand for a show that I did not get, and he remembered me. And then, coincidentally, at the same time, they were casting, and they had their offices on Paramount lot. I was doing a guest star on Taxi, and so I was playing this kind of light in the loafers hairdresser on Taxi, and running over to the offices and talking to them at the same time. So it came out of Jimmy remembering me and then auditioning. And I remember that they, you know, at one point they said, well, we're interested. Don't take anything else, you know. Don't take any other shows without letting us know. And I said, so does that mean you want me to do this part? And they went, well, yeah, don't take any other parts. And I walked out the door thinking, wow, you know, I've got this. And I looked down this long hallway and saw this line of actors going in the other door. And then when we actually auditioned for it in front of the network and everything, they had three actors and three actresses to play Sam and Diane. And they had a little stage set up. And it was this little act-off, you know, where each couple would come out and do a scene and then leave. Then the other couple would come out. And that's, I think I got the part because Shelley and I were good together. Shelley was remarkable. And I think I got the part because Shelley was so good and I worked well with Shelley, to be honest. I think that's how that happened.
Did you feel like you knew this character?
No, Lord, no. I didn't. I had no idea how unintelligent he was. At first, I thought he was making these, because Sam would come out with these things that were funny, and I thought, well, maybe he's being ironic. You know, maybe he's smart enough to know that he's saying stupid things in the beginning. I think it took me about a year and a half before, maybe a season and a half, before I had an inkling on how to play Sam Malone, because he was a relief pitcher, which comes with a certain amount of arrogance. You know, you only get called in when you're in trouble and you're there to save the day. And that takes a special kind of arrogance, I think. And Sam Malone had that arrogance, and I, Ted Danson, did not. I was nervous, scared, excited about, you know, grateful about my new job.
Well, let's hear a scene from season one, and we'll hear the kind of arrogance that you're talking about, that your character...
Or lack of.
Or yeah. Lack of, that your character Sam Malone had. So here's a scene with you and Shelley Long.
Why are you so upset?
You know, this week I have gone out with all the women I know. I mean, all the women I really enjoyed. And all of a sudden, all I can think about is how stupid they are. I mean, my life isn't fun anymore. And it's because of you.
Because of me?
Yeah. You're a snob.
A snob?
Yeah, that's right.
Well, you're a rapidly aging adolescent.
Well, I would rather be that than a snob.
And I would rather be a snob.
Well, good, because you are.
Sam, do yourself a favor. Go back to your Tootsies and your rat parts. I'd hate to see the bowling alleys close on my account.
Hey, wait a minute. Are you saying that I'm too dumb to date smart women?
I'm saying that it would be very difficult for you. A really intelligent woman would see your line of BS a mile away.
You think so, huh?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, well, you know, I've never met an intelligent woman that I'd want to date.
On behalf of the intelligent women around the world, may I just say,
whew. It's Ted Danson and Shelley Long. So Ted Danson, was that before you felt like you could pull off the arrogance of your character?
Yeah, actually it was. I can actually hear it in my voice, you know. I really, you know, I want to sing Shelley Long's praises. I think the first couple of years, Cheers became the hit that it was because I mean, everyone was good in it, and everyone went on to become brilliant in it. But I think Shelley and that character hadn't been seen for a while on TV, and I think she just did an absolute brilliant, brilliant job.
You know, I remember when I, in one of my interviews with the late actor Spalding Gray, he said he always had trouble acting on TV because he's so interior and always so caught up in his thoughts. So whenever he was on TV, he said he'd look like really worried and preoccupied, and that you needed the certain kind of like Zen TV face. And I'm wondering, you know, I mean, you went to Stanford, you went to prep school, you're obviously like very well educated. Was it hard to get that kind of blankness or that lack of introspection that Sam had?
I just, once again, I think it was Kelsey Grammer has had this great phrase. It probably has been said before, but I heard it from him, that you need, an actor needs a requisite disrespect for the material. Instead of holding it up as the Holy Grail, you know, you need to have a kind of requisite disrespect for it, because then you're not eager, too eager. You're not too leaning forward. And when I first started Cheers, I think I was very eager, and if this makes any sense, I was tilting too far forward. And it took me that year and a half, that season and a half, to get that more relaxed, leaning back, slightly arrogant, you know, let people vote, who cares, here I am, I'm going to have fun. And when I got that relaxation, I also got the fun of the stupid character. I got the fun, I mean, the stupid joke is the best joke in comedy. I mean, it's fantastic, it's fun, it's full of innocence, and it's really, really funny. So I think that all kind of came together for me in about a season and a half.
My guest is Ted Danson. He co-stars in the new HBO series, Bored to Death. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview with Ted Danson. Was it hard to create a new life after Cheers?
Well, I had this great solution. I blew my private life up in such a, you know, disastrous way that leaving Cheers became secondary to kind of putting my private life back together. So to answer your question, not really. Not really. There was so much going on in my life, my personal life, that took my focus that, you know, it wasn't that hard. I mean, it was hard because I missed my friends. It was hard. But after 11 years, I think we all had been looking for an ending.
And let me just say, I think what you were alluding to before when you said that after Cheers, your life became public and in a big way, I think you're referring to the relationship with Whoopi Goldberg and the whole Friars Club thing, where there was a roast of Whoopi Goldberg and you worked out a sketch with her in which you appeared in blackface. And like, boy, there were just like movie stars and politicians and columnists who were so upset and publicly spoke out against you for having done that. It must have been a horrible, a horrible moment.
It was, but I mean, it was of my making, so, you know, it was all on my head. It was definitely a graceless moment in my life. But I kept thinking, well, I have to go roast Whoopi Goldberg. We were no longer actually going together at that moment, and we had tried to back out of, you know, of doing this, and they said, no, you have to, contractually, you have to. And I thought, well, how am I going to roast Whoopi when all the tapes and videos I see of people are, a Jewish person will be saying horrible things about the Jewish person they're roasting, but it's okay because the Jewish person being roasted is being roasted by Jewish people, or, you know, the African American is being roasted by an African American. So how's the white kid going to be roasting and doing an outrageous job for this amazingly outrageous woman? So I thought, I know, I'm not a stand-up comic, but I'll do I am an actor, so I'll do a little performance theater. So that was my rationale, and it was clearly a non-press event, we were told. And within seconds, I realized, ooh, wow. It was like sticking my finger in a light socket. I was like, it went very still in my head, and I went, okay, 50% of the people get this and think it's funny. By the way, Whoopi knew about it and had kind of signed off on it and thought it was funny. So I thought, okay, I'm going to go for it. 50% got it, liked it. 30% got it, hated it. 20% didn't get it and hated it. So it was this very, you know, graceless and courageous moment of, okay, here I go. And it did offend some people. And sometimes I'd have to say rightfully so. Other times it was theater and it was done with love.
Do you feel like you walked away learning anything either about comedy or about race in America from that experience?
Well, yeah. The stupidity on my part, the lack of thought to stand up and go, I'm now going to do race material, and think that it would not draw a lot of heat was stupid on my part. So what did I learn? You know, I learned that I was at a very adolescent point in my life where I thought, you know what, I can do whatever I want. It's okay, you know. And I was wrong. I did not take my family into consideration. I did not take... I did naively think, because I was told that there would be no press, so I thought, okay, this is a room full of people who get this kind of humor, I'll be all right. And that was stupid on my part. Everything is open to the press now.
You know what I found really interesting about what you just said? You're saying that, you know, that you think you were arrogant then. And you were telling us before that you didn't know how to be arrogant. Like you didn't have that arrogance, and you had to learn it to play Sam on Cheers. And you were telling us about the kind of arrogance that you needed to have for the part that you play on Damages. This is like billionaire CEO who's like very arrogant. And it's interesting, you're talking about this moment in your life where you were arrogant for real, you think, and you got really burned.
Yeah. You know, actually, what followed, a week later, I had a replay, because evidently I hadn't learned my lesson, where I was driving in a car up a hill, and it was rainy, and I was late, and I was driving a little faster than I should, and I could feel my tires start to skid a little bit, and I almost had this literal thought, maybe not quite, but it was like, Ted, you better slow down. The roads are wet. And I went, no, I'm all right. I can handle this. And it was that same kind of arrogance of the world saying, hey, there are rules. Don't break the rules. And I spun out and got hit by a pickup coming the other way and slammed into the side of the cliff. Luckily, didn't go off the other end, you know, the other side, which was a cliff. And I was taken out of my car on a board, and it was all very dramatic. And I was fine. The next day, I had a stiff neck, and that was it. But it was... And that was like the moment where I went, whew, wake up.
So what did you do after that, like, wake up moment? What did you change?
Then it was kind of personal, so I won't go into that.
No, it's fine.
It was ending things that I should have ended. It was, I really did actually take care of business. And about a month later, I met Mary. And I don't think that I would have even seen her, or she would have even seen me, if I hadn't, you know, woken up.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Ted Danson, and he's co-starring in a new series that begins this weekend on HBO, and it's called Bored to Death. I'd like to talk about your childhood a little bit. I know you grew up near Flagstaff, Arizona. Your father was an archaeologist, and he directed a museum. What kind of museum was it?
It was a natural history museum that part of its mandate was to honor and stimulate the culture and the arts and the crafts of the Hopi, Navajo, Zuni, and Pueblo Indians in the Four Corners area, that Utah, New Mexico, Colorado, Arizona area. So most of my friends growing up were the sons of Hopi and Navajo people who worked at the museum and or ranchers' sons and daughters. I had a really interesting, kind of idyllic, jump on horses and ride in any direction you want upbringing.
So did you grow up with aspects of Hopi culture that made an impression on you?
Yes, but, you know, I was madly running around playing and jumping on horses and you know, playing cowboys and Indians, which was really weird for us.
Oh, God, you play cowboys and Indians with real Indians.
Yeah, it was very strange. We'd all go off and see, you know, on Sunday we'd take our, you know, our quarter and go to the Orpheum Theater and watch a John Wayne movie and kind of laugh derisively when the Indians that were wearing bonnets, which clearly meant Plains Indians, and they were supposedly Apaches, and we'd mock and laugh them. And then someone would say Yatahe, which is actually Navajo for like a greeting of good morning or how are you. And some Apache would say Yatahe, and then we'd all laugh. And but then when the cavalry would come and just beat the crap out of the Indians, we'd all be kind of still for a moment, not knowing how to handle this kind of moment of, oh, sorry about this.
So when you played cowboys and Indians, were you like the victorious cowboy beaten up on the Indians?
No, we were always on the same side. No, these cowboys and Indians were on the same side. We were always playing, usually against imaginary enemies.
Well, Ted Danson, it's really been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You can see Ted Danson in the new HBO series Bored to Death, which premieres Sunday. Coming up, our producer Anne-Marie Baldonado tells us about what she saw and heard at the Toronto Film Festival. This is Fresh Air. Our producer Anne-Marie Baldonado books a lot of our movie and TV guests, so we sent her to the Toronto Film Festival to scout out interesting movies and future guests. She saw 20 movies that were at the festival. It started last Thursday and concludes this Saturday. Now that Anne-Marie is back, we asked her to tell us about it. So Anne-Marie, in the world of film festivals, what's the Toronto Film Festival's niche?
Well, first of all, it's known as a really people-friendly festival. You know, unlike Sundance or Cannes, regular people go to the screenings. Regular people from the city buy the tickets. They line up. And so they're seeing these movies with film critics from around the world and also with studio execs, either people who have films here or people who are looking to buy films to distribute. They're all seeing these movies together. And the rep about Toronto crowds is that they're very generous. You know, just think about if you're a regular film goer and you get to see a movie that no one else has seen and maybe the star of the film is in the theater with you, you're going to be sort of generous to it. And lots of studios like to bring their films here because of the fact that they're probably going to get a better reception than like at a festival where mostly it's film critics in the audience or something. But also it's sort of the unofficial kickoff of the Oscar season. You know, it's the fall and studios release the films that they think are going to be kind of art housey or films that are in Oscar contention, they bring them here and launch them and hope that showing them here to generous crowds can give them a little bit of a buzz and a little bit of a push that will sort of propel them to the end of the year and get their films nominated. And this year in particular, it's important because of the economic climate. There are fewer film studios have fewer films that they're releasing. And at the same time, the Oscars have expanded their list of Best Picture nominees from 5 to 10. So, you know, that's a lot of spots to fill. So I think people are thinking if they make a big impact at the Toronto Film Festival, they might be on that list.
So are there films that are getting that Oscar buzz at the festival?
Yeah, I would say the film that is getting the most buzz is actually my favorite film of the festival, a film called Up in the Air. It's Jason Reitman's third film. Jason Reitman's first two films actually both showed in Toronto and did well. The first is Thank You for Smoking, and the second was Juno, which 2 years ago did really well, Oscar-wise.
The film Up in the Air is based on a novel that I really love by Walter Kern. And the novel, a lot of it is set on an airplane because it's about somebody who has accumulated all these frequent flyer miles and his goal is to get more. And I read the book on an airplane, on several airplanes. And so I just really loved it because there's so many descriptions of, like, airports and lousy fluorescent lighting in airports and being next to passengers who are talking to you when you don't want to talk and so on. So what's the movie like?
Well, actually, I think Jason Reitman really captures what you're talking about. But he uses the book as a jumping off point. And in a press conference, he was talking about writing the film. He's been writing it for a few years now. The Kern book came out in 2001. And he said when he originally started writing it, I should back up and say that this traveler, the main character of Up in the Air, who's played by George Clooney, his job, he's sort of a corporate hitman. He's the guy that companies hire to do their firing, the character would say, when they don't have the guts to do the firing themselves. So when he started writing this movie a few years ago, you know, it was a different economic time, and he was writing the those firing scenes for comedic value because his films always sort of have a comic bent to them. But as he was writing it and the economic climate changed, firing scenes, you know, they're more real now. It's more what's going on now. And he couldn't write them that way. So he ended up actually putting ads in local papers where they were filming in different cities in the Midwest, trying to find people who had been downsized, who had been let go. And he uses those interviews with these people who have been laid off throughout the film. And the film, because it deals with corporate downsizing, it just feels like the right film for now. Just sort of seems to fit what's going on in the economic climate.
I'm really glad the adaptation was made because the novel came out just about on September 11th, and everything had changed in terms of airports and flying, and this really kind of funny, perceptive book that had so much to do with flying made no sense anymore.
No, and
so it got lost completely.
Yeah, I think Reitman turned it into something else, and I think he's pretty much a shoo-in to get a nomination for adapted screenplay.
So Up in the Air was your favorite film at the festival. Is there another film or two you'd like to mention that you think our listeners should watch out for?
Well, I did like the Coen brothers film. It's called A Serious Man. It's people are saying that it's their most personal film to date. It's about a college professor in the 1960s, a Jewish college professor who's going through some hard times. His wife wants to leave him. He's having trouble with tenure, and his family doesn't understand him. And it's a film that people are kind of assuming, and probably correctly, that it's the most autobiographical. For one, it features a 13-year-old boy who's getting bar mitzvah, and people sort of assume that it's somehow based on the Coen brothers' experiences as children. So it might be a hard sell in that there aren't any stars. You know, the last film they had Brad Pitt in it. A lot of the critics liked it coming out of the festival. Oprah was there as well. She was not in a film, but she came to support a film that she's an executive producer for, a film called Precious, which is also getting a lot of Oscar buzz. It's a film about an obese African-American teenage girl who is abused and actually carrying the second child that she's had with her father. So it's based on a best-selling novel by the poet Sapphire, it's just also getting a lot of buzz for its performances.
So you think we'll have some good movies to talk about on the show?
Hopefully, yeah, and some great guests.
Well, Emory, thanks for reporting to us on what you saw at the Toronto Film Festival.
Thank you very much, Terry.
Anne-Marie Baldonado is one of our producers. You can read more about her experiences at the Toronto Film Festival on NPR's Monkey See blog at npr.org. And you can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Shirok. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. WHYY's chief content officer is Christine Dempsey. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Angie's List, providing consumer reviews on local professionals from doctors and veterinarians to plumbers and roofers. Details at angieslist.com. From the Pew Charitable Trusts, whose financial reform project provides analysis to guide the debate over financial modernization at pewtrusts.org. And from Independent Sector, working to advance the common good by leading, strengthening, and mobilizing the nonprofit community at independentsector.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we listen back to an interview with comedy writer Larry Gelbart. He died last week at age 81. Gelbart developed the TV series MASH, worked on Sid Caesar's show, and co-wrote the book for the Broadway hit A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.